Have you ever looked at a map of the South Pacific and tried to imagine flying a fighter 400 miles over open ocean at 50 feet above the waves, with no margin for error, no room for a wrong turn, and exactly one chance to hit your target? I'm Tail Dragger, and this is The Hangar on Radio Hangar. Pull up a chair because this one still gives me chills. The date was April 18, 1943. 16 P-38 Lightnings from the 339th Fighter Squadron lifted off from Henderson Field on Guadalcanal in the Solomon Islands. Their mission was so secret that only a handful of people on the entire island knew the real objective. The pilots had been told simply that they were going after a high-value target. Most of them did not learn until after they were airborne that they were hunting Admiral Isoroku Yamamoto, the commander-in-chief of the Japanese Combined Fleet, the man who had planned the attack on Pearl Harbor. Now here's where it gets interesting. The intelligence behind this mission was extraordinary. American codebreakers had intercepted and decrypted a Japanese message detailing Yamamoto's exact itinerary. He was flying from Rabaul to Bulalé Airfield, a small island near Bougainville, for a morale-boosting inspection tour of forward bases. The intercept gave his departure time, his arrival time, the number of aircraft in his party, and even the types of planes. Two Mitsubishi G4M Betty bombers carrying Yamamoto and his staff, escorted by six Zeros. The Americans knew the route. They knew the altitude. They knew the time. What they did not know was whether they could actually pull it off. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. So let's talk about the airplane that made this mission possible. Because no other fighter in the American inventory could have done it. The Lockheed P-38 Lightning. Twin engines, twin booms, that distinctive shape that looked like nothing else in the sky. Kelly Johnson's masterpiece, designed at the Lockheed Skunk Works in Burbank, California. The Lightning was fast, it was heavily armed, and critically for this mission, it had range. With external drop tanks, a P-38 could fly over 1,000 miles. No single-engine fighter in 1943 could touch that number. The mission planning fell to Major John Mitchell, who would lead the flight. Mitchell had to plot a course that kept the formation below Japanese radar and out of sight of coast watchers and enemy positions scattered across the Solomon Islands. That meant flying at wavetop height, 50 feet above the Pacific Ocean, for over 2 hours. No autopilot, no GPS, just a compass, a clock, and dead reckoning navigation over featureless water. Think about that for a moment. 16 fighters flying in radio silence at 50 feet above the waves for 435 miles, making four separate doglegs to avoid detection, all timed to arrive at a precise intercept point at exactly the right moment. The margin for error was measured in minutes. If they arrived too early, they would alert the Japanese. Too late, and Yamamoto would already be on the ground. Mitchell planned the navigation down to the minute. Each leg had a specific heading and a specific time. He calculated for wind, for fuel consumption, for the speed difference between cruising with drop tanks and combat speed without them. The whole flight depended on one man's math and a Navy compass that was not designed for this kind of precision navigation. The 16 P-38s were divided into two groups. Four aircraft made up the killer flight, designated to go after the bombers carrying Yamamoto. The other 12 would fly top cover, engaging any Zeros that tried to intervene. The killer flight was led by Captain Thomas Lanfear Jr., with Lieutenant Rex Barber on his wing. Lieutenant Besby Holmes and Lieutenant Raymond Hine rounded out the four. They launched at 07:25 local time. Almost immediately, things started going wrong. One aircraft blew a tire on takeoff and could not get airborne. Another had a mechanical problem and turned back. That left 14 with only two in the killer flight operating at full strength. For the next 2 hours and 10 minutes, those 14 P-38s flew at 50 feet over the Pacific, no talking, no climbing to get a better view, just the roar of those twin Allison 1200 horsepower V-1710 engines and the blur of blue water filling the windscreen. Pilots later said the salt spray from the waves would occasionally miss their canopies. One mistake, one moment of inattention, and you were in the ocean. At 50 feet and over 200 miles per hour, the ocean does not forgive. Mitchell's navigation was near perfect. After four legs totaling over 400 miles, the formation made landfall on the southern coast of Bougainville within 1 minute of the planned intercept time. 1 minute. Over open ocean, with 1943 technology, that alone would make this one of the greatest feats of dead reckoning navigation in military aviation history. And then they saw them. Coming down from the northwest, descending toward Bulalé, two Betty bombers painted dark green, flying at about 4,500 feet, and there were the Zeros, six of them, tucked in close escort formation, Mitchell called it. The killer flight jettisoned their drop tanks and pushed the throttles forward. The top cover climbed to 18,000 feet to engage the Zeros. Now the accounts of what happened next have been debated for decades. Lenfiere and Barber both claimed the kill on Yamamoto's bomber, and the controversy lasted for the rest of their lives. What we know from the wreckage and from Japanese records is this. Yamamoto's Betty, the lead bomber, was struck by a concentrated burst of 50 caliber fire. The rounds tore through the left engine, the left wing, and the fuselage. The aircraft dove into the jungle canopy of Bougainville and exploded on impact. When a Japanese search party found the wreckage the next day, they found Admiral Yamamoto still strapped in his seat, his white-gloved hand resting on the hilt of his katana. He had been killed by gunfire that entered the fuselage before the crash. The second Betty, carrying Yamamoto's chief of staff, Vice Admiral Motomi Ugaki, was also hit. It crashed into the ocean just offshore. Ugaki survived with injuries, one of only three survivors from both aircraft. Rex Barber's P-38 took hits from the Zero escorts. He nursed his damaged Lightning back toward Guadalcanal. Raymond Hine was not so lucky. He never returned, and no trace of his aircraft was ever found. He was the only American loss in the mission. The remaining pilots regrouped and flew the 400 miles back to Henderson Field. When they landed, Mitchell reportedly walked up to the intelligence officer and said simply, "That son of a gun will not be dictating any peace terms in the White House." The aftermath was complicated. The Americans could not publicize the mission because it would reveal that they had broken the Japanese naval code. The official story was that a routine patrol had stumbled across the aircraft. The truth remained classified for years. Lanphier and Barber spent decades arguing over who fired the fatal shots. Modern analysis of the wreckage trajectory and bullet angles, conducted in the 1990s, tends to favor Barber's account. But the truth is that both pilots made attack runs and both likely hit the target. War is not a shooting gallery with clear scorecards. What strikes me every time I think about this mission is not the combat, it is the navigation. John Mitchell flew 14 fighters over 400 miles of open ocean at 50 feet, made four dogleg turns, and arrived within 60 seconds of the planned intercept time. He did it with a compass and a watch, no inertial navigation, no moving map, no satellite, just headings and time and the kind of airmanship that you cannot teach in a simulator. And the P-38 made it all possible. That airplane was one of the true marvels of the war. Two engines meant you could take a hit and still get home. Counter-rotating propellers eliminated torque, which made it stable as a gun platform. The concentrated nose armament, one 20mm cannon, and 450 caliber machine guns, all firing straight ahead without propeller synchronization, gave it devastating firepower, and the range, that beautiful improbable range that let a fighter do what fighters were not supposed to be able to do. The Lightning served in every theater of the war. Richard Bong, America's all-time leading ace with 40 confirmed kills, flew a P-38, so did Thomas McGuire, the second highest ace, with 38. In the Pacific, where distances were vast and targets were far, the P-38 was the airplane that could get there and get back. Lockheed built just under 10,000 P-38s during the war. Today, fewer than a dozen are still airworthy. If you ever get the chance to see one fly, take it. There is nothing else that sounds like a Lightning. Those twin Allisons have a distinctive harmonic that old Pacific Theater veterans say they can still identify 60 years later. It is not the snarl of a Merlin or the thunder of a radial. It is a smooth twin-engine song that carries for miles back. When AVGAS was cheap and airspace was free, those engines carried young men across oceans to do impossible things. Operation Vengeance was one of the most precisely planned and flawlessly executed fighter missions of the entire war. 16 aircraft, one target, 400 miles of ocean, and 1 minute of margin. That story draws from several sources, including John Mitchell's own debriefs, Carol Glein's book Attack on Yamamoto, and declassified Navy intelligence records from the National Archives. You can find more at radiohangar.com. I'm Tail Dragger. Go see a Lightning if one flies near you this summer. You will not forget the sound.